We're looking this evening at David's conflict with Goliath. And especially at these words in the verse 29, is there not a cause? These words of David are his response to his brother Eliab's challenge to David's presence on the battlefield. Eliab, as you will have noticed in the verse 28, spoke with anger to David, expressing his own view that David was only there on the battlefield out of a foolish, idle curiosity. David speaks here in his own defense, and he says, is there not a cause? In other words, is there not a reason for me to be here? Is there not a reason for me to do as I have done? The words then in this question explain his presence on the battlefield, but they do more than that, because they explain the rationale in David's mind and heart at this point in time for him asking and inquiring about what will be done to the man who kills Goliath. Already at this point in time, David is forming the desire and forming the intention to fight with Goliath. That is evident from his words. Certainly that's the meaning from his words and inquiries that the servants of Saul took. And they carry the report back to Saul about how David is expressing an interest and a desire to fight with Goliath. So when David says to Eliab, is there not a cause? Is there not a reason? He is explaining these two things. First, why he's on the battlefield at all. And second, why he is going to fight with Goliath. David was on the battlefield because, according to verse 17, he had been sent by his father to seek the welfare of his brethren. There in verse 18 as well. Carry these 10 cheeses unto the captain of their 1,000, and look how thy brethren fare, and take their pledge. His father had sent him to look out for the welfare of his brethren. He later on, we are told in the verse 22 that he came and saluted his brethren. He asked of his brethren peace, literally. He comes to look out for them, to see how they fare. He has their interests at heart. He has been sent by the Father in the interests of his brethren, and that's why he's on the battlefield. Now, although Jesse originally had only sent David with the intention in mind of carrying some food to his brothers and of bringing a present to the captain of their 1,000, yet under God, that mission to seek for the welfare of his brethren also came to include David standing up and conquering Goliath. That was for their welfare. That certainly was for their good, and that certainly was for their peace, as he came not only to bring them those ordinary necessary things for the body, to bring food and to bring comfort and to bring greetings from their father, but to bring victory, to bring to them peace and welfare as the champion of the Philistines, who had risen up against them, was slain and conquered. Now there is tremendous foreshadowing of Christ in various ways in the events of this chapter. There are events here that foreshadow the first coming of Christ, as he came, as David did, as the good shepherd, coming to conquer the giant of sin and death, and to lay low in defeat and in the dust of death, even Satan himself bruising and crushing the head of the serpent. There are overtones here that relate to his second coming. Coming as the chief shepherd, we are told, to judge the wicked, to pour out his wrath upon the champion of evil that is yet to arise, even the Antichrist himself, and doing literally what David spoke figuratively of to the Philistines, giving the flesh of the armies of the Antichrist to the birds and the fowls of the air. You'll read of that in Isaiah 66. The coming of Christ is foreshadowed here as he returns in power and in great glory to conquer Antichrist and his armies. There are things that relate to that. But we can at least learn general lessons here. Even in relation to Christ himself, we have seen how David in so many ways resembles the Savior and resembles Christ. He who was the one who always pleased his Father, John 8:29, I do always those things that please him. And here's David saying now to his brother, is there not a cause? Why, I'm here at the Father's command. I'm here doing my Father's will. I'm here in obedience to his desires, seeking out for the welfare of his children. And how even in this he is like Christ. You know how much better we would conduct ourselves if we lived as David lived and as Christ himself lived, doing the will of our Father, living to seek the peace and the welfare of the family of God. David here, though he was rebuked, had an answer. He could justify what he's doing because he says, I have a command from my Father. I'm here to do you good. And is there not even in that a lesson for us all? We may encounter rebuke, we may encounter difficulties and circumstances that are not particularly pleasant, but if we're there at the Father's command, if we can honestly say we have come at the Father's bidding, seeking only the welfare and the good of his children and the advance of our brethren, then we have justification indeed for what we do. And David, in this question, is there not a cause, indicates to Eliab these things. I've been sent by the Father. I'm doing his will. I'm looking out only for your good and for your welfare. And that's his justification for being there. And that silences the reproof of Eliab, his brother. But as I've already indicated, David even now is forming the intention of fighting Goliath. And it is with this thought in mind that we want to look at the events of the chapter this evening. David formed the intention now of fighting with Goliath because there was a cause, because there was a reason. He pursued that path, he pursued that course of taking a stand against the champion of the Philistines because there was a reason. There was good reason to do so. Many others were there who didn't see the reasoning, who couldn't see any reason to act as David acted. But David saw it. And seeing the reason, he determined in his heart before God, and in the strength and grace and wisdom of the Spirit, not in the foolhardiness of youth, not in the naughtiness and pride of his heart, as Eliab had alleged, but with spiritual, clear-headed thinking, David determined, I'm going to take a stand here. I'm going to stand against this champion because there's a reason to do so. He saw the reasons. We're going to think about those reasons this evening. And I believe that there is an application of them to our own heart. Because if you think of what David says even to Eliab, his question is intended to be, I believe, to be a challenge. It is a challenge to Eliab's heart. It is in the form of a question. He asks him, Eliab, don't you see there's a cause? There is a reason to act in this way. And even by asking the question and making his point in the form of a question, he is challenging Eliab to recognize there's something more needs to be done here. All the posturing, all the setting up of the battle lines and all that had been done for 40 days at least up until this point in time was all utterly worthless. It had accomplished nothing. David came to the realization. He saw the reason. Something has to be done. He saw good reason to take a stand against Goliath. And he challenges Eliab. And I believe the word should come as a challenge to our own hearts tonight. Is there not a cause? Is there not a reason for us to act as David acted on that occasion? To stand for God, to stand for his cause, even to challenge and to take on and under God to conquer the giants that we will encounter in the warfare of faith in our own day. I want us to look at this passage then with that in mind. First of all, to see that there is good reason to act as David did, because the cause of God faces constant challenge. The constant challenge of the enemy is brought before us here in this passage. In the verse 2 we read that, or the verse 1 rather, that the Philistines gathered their armies to battle. The Philistines were one of the most ancient of the enemies of the people of God. Time and again they had proved to be vicious haters of Israel, vicious enemies of the cause of God in that nation. For generations now, they had been a thorn in the side of the people of Israel. Many campaigns and battles had been waged against them. Many times, it is true, they had been defeated. It's not very long previous to this point in time that they had been defeated under Samuel. They'd been defeated not long before that under Samson. And time and again down through history they had been beaten, but time and again they rise to challenge again the people of God and the cause of God. They represent an enemy that never goes away. They represent an enemy that plagues the people of God, that though it has been conquered in this generation, rises again in the next, and the battle has to be engaged in all over. Now, the people of God in this day and age face such enemies. We don't literally face the Philistines, but we face enemies that are the age-old enemies of the cause of God, that though they've been defeated and dealt with in times past, you have false doctrines, you have heresies that today are prevalent, and you can trace them right back to the beginning of time. You can trace the error in many instances back to even the very beginnings of the New Testament church. And yet that doctrine, though defeated in that generation, and defeated again in that era, and again and again and again, it rises, it comes to the surface, it comes back again, and the battle is one that must be engaged in over and over and over again. Every generation of the people of God must fight against those age-old enemies. The same old sins come up, the same old doctrines come up, the same old errors and blasphemies come up time and time and time again. And there is reason, therefore, to act as David did, to stand and to challenge the enemies of God. Because they never go away. The Church of Jesus Christ never gets to the point where there are no enemies. Well, at least not until we get to glory. There will always be the old battles to be fought again and again. From among the ranks of these old enemies, there now rises a special challenger in the person of Goliath. Such champions of evil periodically have emerged in the history of the warfare of the faith. Time and again, there have been men to rise like Goliath from out of the ranks of the enemies of the gospel and the enemies of Christ, who are men of gigantic stature in their opposition to God. Here is a man who literally was a giant. There are many who have followed in his footsteps who have been giants in the sense that they have risen to great heights in their opposition and their defiance of the Lord. In verse 4 through 8 you have a description of Goliath, and what a daunting picture is painted of him here. A man who is formidable, almost impregnable, proof against attack, it seems. He cannot be defeated as far as the natural eye is concerned. He is a man of such power, such ability, such standing, such force, such energy, that he cannot be overcome. He is a larger than life figure who engages in loud-mouthed, brass-necked defiance of God and of his people. He's a champion of evil. It's interesting just to draw the parallel between Goliath and Antichrist himself. Just as Christ had many forerunners, so the Antichrist, the final manifestation of the champion of evil, the man of sin, the son of perdition himself, is a man who will be, according to the scriptures, a man vocal in his assaults and attacks upon the people of God. Just one of the references that indicate that is found in Revelation chapter 13, which is a chapter that relates to the Antichrist himself and to the period of his influence upon the earth. In Revelation 13 and the verse 5, there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. You have the same kind of language in the book of Daniel as well, where it is one of the prominent characteristics of the man of sin that he is loud-mouthed in his defiance of God. Goliath is such a man, a forerunner, a foreshadowing, like many others down through the course of history, a foreshadowing of the man of sin. Even too, we can look upon him as an embodiment of the hatred of Satan, the enmity of Satan. You'll know that that name even means adversary, the enemy. Satan being the archenemy of the people of God. And here is a man doing the devil's work. Here is a man who has about him many devilish characteristics. He stands up and with a loud voice defies God and his people. For a long period of time, his opposition is unanswered. For at least 40 days, we are told, the Philistine drew near morning and evening and presented himself 40 days, verse 16. Morning and night for those 40 days, on 80 given occasions, day after day after day, he stands and with a loud mouth defies God, blasphemes God, and defies the armies of Israel. Not so much to defy the soldiers, but to defy the God of Israel. That's who he is speaking in defiance of. Here is a special assault then upon the cause of God. A special situation has arisen. Not just the re-emergence of an old enemy, but out of the ranks of those enemies has come a special champion of evil. And the very existence of such a champion is reason for David to say, it's time somebody took him on. It's time for somebody to go and fight with this champion of evil. Such special attacks on the cause of God are reason for every child of God to act as David. Is there not a cause? Oh yes, there is. The presence of Goliath was a reason. The presence of the enemy was a reason. And so long as the enemies of God persist in their attacks upon the gospel, upon the word of God, upon the person of Christ, there's a reason. There is a cause for you and for me to be on the battlefield. There is a cause for there to be a desire born within our heart to say, Lord, I'm going to stand. If nobody else stands, I'm going to stand. If nobody else wants to take him on, I'm going to take him on. There is a reason. David saw it. There's a reason for us to act that way in our day. We have champions of evil. We have those who are more prominent in their opposition to the cause of God than other ordinary enemies are. There are special issues that arise. There are maybe in some circumstances, it's not maybe so much a particular personage that comes to the fore, but maybe it's an issue that comes to the fore. It's an issue that demands dealing with. Oh, that God would give us the heart of David and say there's a cause to fight. There's a reason here in this for us to stand and to form the intention of doing battle for the sake of the gospel and of our God. The second thing is this. There is reason to act as David acted because it is the duty of God's people to resist his enemies. That is the duty of the people of God. It was the duty of Israel to engage in warfare against those who raised themselves up against God. When the cause of God is under attack, the people of God have a duty. It's not just something that is an option, it is a duty. Just as it is a duty for the soldier in any national army, in the day when his country and his country's interests come under attack, he has a duty to stand. He has a duty to serve. And you know how seriously the powers that be will look upon someone in such circumstances who shirk their duty, who run away from their duty, who don't carry through on their duty. Your country's under attack, you're not going to stand. The cause of your God is under attack. How poorly the God of heaven must look upon those who claim to be his soldiers, who will not stand to fight in his cause. 1 Timothy chapter 3, in the verse 15. Indicate that this is indeed the duty of the Church of Jesus Christ. Paul, writing to Timothy, says, "But if I tarry long, that thou mightest know how thou oughtest to behave thyself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth." And it's not so very long ago since we had Reverend Wagner preach on that text, and he pointed out very ably that it is the duty of the Church of Jesus Christ to defend the truth. That's what the words mean. The pillar and the ground of truth indicate the duty of the Church of Christ is to defend truth from attack. It is our calling. There is a reason to act as Paul acted, where he said, "I am set for the defense of the gospel," Philippians 1:17. David saw the reason. The cause of God was under attack, and he recognized that there was a duty to act in its defense. Now Saul and his men recognized this to some degree as well. For in verse 2 of 1 Samuel 17, we read that in response to the activity of the Philistines, Saul and the men of Israel were also gathered together, and they set the battle in array against the Philistines. They had gathered the army, they set up the battle lines, and yet it is very clear that they lacked the courage, they lacked the power, they lacked the zeal to do what was needed. Here is a demonstration of the powerlessness of the people of God at this time. Yes, they recognize we have to go fight, but there doesn't seem to be much heart for the fight. There doesn't seem to be much zeal for the fight. They're prepared to sit for 40 days and 40 nights and listen to Goliath. And they listen to his blasphemies, and they listen to his challenge, and they listen to his defiance of God. And there's not a cheap word of the men of Israel. Not a word. Not a word. Oh, how many of God's people are like that today. And they can hear the name of God blasphemed and the truth of the gospel impugned and the Bible denied and Christ blasphemed and mocked, and they never say a thing. Oh, they know it's wrong. They might rattle their sword a little bit in the sheath, but they never get it out. And they never get to fight. They never get to stand up and do something for the Lord's honor and to do something in defense of his interests. What a demonstration of powerlessness there is here. And sadly, that powerlessness prevails so much at times in our own lives and in the cause of Christ generally. There's not much heart for the warfare. Goliath issued a challenge. "Send me a man." He defies God. The situation begs for a man to stand and to take him on. Saul was the natural choice. Chapter 10 and 23 indicates, you'll remember there, the simple information how that Saul was higher than any of the people. He stood head and shoulders above any of them. If all the armies of Israel were on their feet, Saul was higher than any of them. He was the natural choice. But Saul had no heart to engage in Goliath. Jonathan, the king's son, had previously to this proved himself capable of great exploits under God. In chapter 14, Jonathan and his armor bearer go and challenge one of the garrisons of the Philistines, and the Lord gives them a victory, and between the two of them they kill 20 Philistines. Jonathan, in faith, it says, it may be the Lord will work for us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few. Here's a man then who has experience of God in a difficult battle situation and taking on the enemy, but he has no heart for the fight now. Though he had proved himself capable of these exploits for God in the past, he doesn't do anything now. Oh, there's no guarantee that the man who has stood in the past will stand again today. There's no guarantee, because men who have done great things for God in former times can lose out with God, can lose power, can lose zeal, can lose their energy for the battle, can lose their heart and their courage for to stand for the Lord. Abner, a mighty man, later described by David in chapter 26 in the verse 15 as a valiant man, that there was none like him in all Israel. But Abner, in spite of his power, a man who, it appears from the scriptural record, had a very strong, even an iron personality, a man who set his mind to something and he did it, a man of force, a man of valor, and he didn't take up Goliath's challenge. And for a time, the blasphemies and the deprecations of Goliath went unanswered. It's clear that physical or natural qualifications and even past experience were not sufficient to rouse these men to engage in this warfare. When good men lose out with God, they lose their heart for the battle, they lose power, they lose zeal. And instead of a heart and courage and zeal, we find in verse 11 that when Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistine, they were dismayed. They were broken. Broken men. Broken in fear. They were greatly afraid. Verse 24, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him, fled from his face, and were sore afraid. They were intimidated, so intimidated by Goliath's person, by Goliath's words, that they were utterly broken as far as their spirit was concerned. Their only response was empty posturing and noise. They drew up the battle lines and they didn't do another thing. Look at the verse 20. The morning that David gets there, the day that David gets there, he gets there just as the host was going forth to the fight and shouted for the battle. Oh, a great shout in the camp. But when Goliath shouted back, they were broken. No answer. They were psyching themselves up, perhaps, to go, to stand on the battle lines. But there wasn't a man among them to stand and to take on Goliath. Not a single man in all the armies. How powerless the cause of God is at times. Do we not live in such a time? Do we not live in a day when there are few, if any, that have the power of God resting upon them to stand up, to take on the enemy and to silence the Goliaths of our day? We live in a day when we must acknowledge it, even in our own hearts we tremble. Even against or in the face of the opposition of those who we do face, and they're only pygmies in comparison to Goliath, just little enemies, but we tremble before them, our hearts faint, we're afraid to speak. Powerlessness that afflicts the cause of God. But David saw the reason. saw his duty, and it energized him to act. It's just interesting to observe in these verses that David, all the way through here, demonstrates the heart of a servant, a man doing his duty, a man under obligation. Look at the verse 20. David rose up early in the morning and left the sheep with the keeper and took and went as Jesse had commanded. It was a matter of obedience. He submits to the will of his father, and under obligation he goes. He does what he's told. He acts as a servant. Verse 32. In his conversation with Saul, and he repeats this a number of times, "Thy servant will go fight with this Philistine." In the verse 45. "Then said David to the Philistine, Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts." Now, one of the things that will indicate is that he's coming as the servant of God. He's coming as one sent by God. He's coming on divine authority. He has a mission from God to deal with that Philistine giant. He's acting as one under an obligation, conscious of his duty. I wonder, do we have any sense really of that duty resting upon us? A commission from our Father, a commission from our King, a commission from our God to take on those that would raise themselves against the cause of truth and righteousness. Now, David's sense of duty in doing battle with Goliath can be easily gauged by a number of hurdles that he had to overcome in order to actually get to the point where he was going to fight with Goliath and to take him on. He overcame, first of all, the anger of his brother. In verse 28, as soon as David even gives the slightest indication that he has only an interest in going to fight Goliath, immediately there is the kindling of Eliab's wrath. Eliab, his elder brother's anger was kindled, and he asked, "Why camest thou down hither? With whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle." He's only at this point forming the intention. He is at the very earliest stages of challenging the Philistine giant, and right away he has to deal with the wrath of his brother. Many a child of God has found that when they begin to take a stand for God, they're going to incur the wrath of their own flesh and blood. They're going to incur the wrath, even on many occasions, of their spiritual brethren. For there's so many Christians today that if you stand for God, they're on your case right away, saying you're only making trouble. You're only acting in pride. You're only acting out of the naughtiness of your heart. How many times the child of God who in their own life desires, "Lord, there are things I got to challenge here. There are sins, there are words maybe that are being spoken. There are issues and circumstances that are developing. I have to do something about them." The minute they begin to act, the wrath of flesh and blood comes on their head, even the wrath of fellow believers. Did David let it stop him? No. And it's just as well for Eliab that David didn't let it stop him. Because Eliab would have been one of the ones that would have been made mincemeat of by the giant if David hadn't stepped in and challenged him and conquered him. David was acting in Eliab's best interest here. And the thing is, even though he was acting for Eliab's peace and Eliab's welfare, he didn't recognize it and he got mad. And when we challenge those who challenge the cause of God, we're acting in the best interests of the people of God. But very often it's those very people that we're trying to help will be the ones who will turn and will demonstrate anger and opposition. That must have hurt David, don't you think? Here's a young lad who, under the influence of the Holy Spirit, recognizing I have a duty here. God has given me an opportunity now, and feeling the prompting of the Holy Ghost in his soul to stand and do something, and his own brother turns against him. That must have hurt. Because you know, Holy Ghost filled men are not immune to the natural feelings of pain and emotional trauma. David would have felt it. He would have felt it deeply. In any other circumstance, as the youngest, he would well have listened to his oldest brother. But he can't listen to him here, alive. I can't listen to you. I can't take your advice. I can't not go. God has set before me a duty. And if you're not going to do it, I'm going to do it. He had to run the gauntlet of the displeasure of his brother. Then he had to deal with the interference of Saul. He had this sense of duty, but Saul had already meddled in the case. It's interesting that in the verse 15, David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. You remember we left off in chapter 16, where David had been made Saul's armor bearer. David should have been there. Saul sent him home. The man who would bring victory to Israel, the man who would be the conqueror of the giant, Saul had sent him home. But God engineered his return to the battlefield. Saul had already meddled in the case and made things difficult. David was in Bethlehem when he should have been in the valley of Elah, and but for the intervention of God, that's where he would have stayed, in Bethlehem. The giant would have gone unchallenged, but the Lord worked things out, and he, despite Saul's folly, worked it out that David would be there in the right place at the right time. But then, you'll see at the verse 33, now that David has formed the intention of going to fight against the Philistine, Saul meddles a little more, and he says, "Thou art not able to go. Thou art but a youth. You're not able to do it. You can't do it." He wasn't ready to go himself, but he was sure going to discourage David from going. He didn't want him to go. "You're not able to do it. You don't have the ability." And he poured cold water upon David's enthusiasm and his zeal to do his duty for God. Then, as if that wasn't enough, and David pressed on and said, "No, I'm going to go. I'm going to fight. I'm going to do it. I have the ability, because God has given and will give the necessary power to fight this Philistine." And as if that wasn't enough, in verse 38, Saul interferes again. Saul armed David with his armor, put a helmet of brass upon his head. Also he armed him with a coat of mail. I don't know, I may be wrong, but I have the idea that Saul wasn't really being that helpful here. Personally, I think that Saul was trying a real smart move here, so that if David went out to fight Goliath, what would the people see? They'd see the king's armor. And I have no doubt that there were those who would have come to the conclusion, "That's Saul. That's Saul fighting." Maybe that was in his mind. Maybe it was in his heart. I don't know. But certainly, that I think is suggested here as being a real possibility. Certainly it's something that the Christian soldier will have to wrestle with, even in his own heart. Because those are the tactics of the flesh. Wanting to take the glory, wanting to take the honor. Here's a Spirit-anointed man going out to fight. It's David. He's going to do battle with Goliath. But all the while, Saul has the idea of making it appear that it looks like him doing it. We have a duty to stand for the cause and the truth of God, to do battle with the Goliaths and the Philistines of our day. But how often it is that the old nature will want to take the glory for that, want to take the credit. And if words are spoken that have power, well, the flesh will want to delight in the natural gift of oratory and of good speaking and of the intellect to form good words and to rob God of the glory. And David, of course, has none of this. No, I can't take this stuff. I'm going to go with the weapons that I have trusted, that I have proved. But Saul interferes. And the Spirit-anointed defender of truth, having a desire to rise up, to do battle with the giant, must deal with such tactics as David had to deal with here from Saul. There will be the discouragement of the flesh. You're not able to do this. No, you can't. You don't have the power. You don't have the ability. That's one of the flesh's most successful tactics. Here's a situation develops before the Christian. A chance to speak a word for God. An issue comes up, you know, I must speak. I should say something. But I can't. I can't. I can't. I don't have the words. I don't have the ability. That's Saul speaking. David pressed on and said, oh, yes, I can, because God can give me the power and give me the strength that is necessary to overcome. His sense of duty then is indicated also by the fact that he resisted not only the anger of his brother and the interference of Saul, but he resisted the scorn of the enemy. Goliath, in verse 42, looked about, almost as if he couldn't see David. Where is this little bug on the landscape? Where is he? He looked about with disdain. For David was just a young lad, still had the fresh face of just a young teenager at this point. A fair countenance. He's coming with his staff, shepherd's staff in his hand. The Philistine says, am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? And he cursed David by his gods. And still David came on. The Philistine scorns him and says, I'm going to give you to the birds to eat. And still David came on. In fact, verse 48. The Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David. And David hasted and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. He runs to meet him. Such is his sense of joy and enthusiasm in the duty to defend the cause of God that he runs to meet the giant that is scorning and mocking him. The onslaught of the mockery has no effect. It only speeds him up, probably. It only makes him run. But you know, that has a withering effect on our courage. That has a withering effect on our zeal whenever men start to mock us. We can start to speak for the Lord, speak a word of defense in his cause, and out comes the scorn and we just wilt. But not David. Oh, that the Lord would give us his heart to stand up before the scorn of men, to carry through our duty to God. None of these things moved him. Like Paul, none of these things moved me that I might finish my course with joy. But finally, the reason that David saw to act was a reason bolstered by faith. Is there not a cause? It was faith that saw the cause. It was faith that saw the reason and that acted upon it. Because the whole thinking of David in this incident is founded upon the logic of faith. Let me just show you his logic as it works itself out. His thinking, his rationale at this time. First of all, he saw God. Verse 26. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? That's David's first reaction to what he heard. All the others around him were running in fear, broken in their spirit. And David said, who is this fellow that he should defy the armies of the living God? He saw the Lord. In verse 45, there's yet more indication of his sight of God at this time. Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. It was God that David had his eye upon. It is the Lord who is the whom here. Goliath had defied God, and David had his eye on the God whom Goliath had blasphemed and mocked. This day, verse 46, the Lord will deliver me or deliver thee into mine hand. Then the final sentence in the verse, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Here is faith. David is a man who has his eye upon God. His faith in the Lord has been proved and nourished and strengthened by his own personal experience of God that he relates to Saul at this time. In the verse 37, speaking of how it was the Lord that delivered him out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, and he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. That's why he spoke as he did. That's why he said, I'm going to go fight him. But you're not able, but I'm going to fight him because I have my eye on the Lord. His whole reasoning is based upon the logic of faith, a faith that sees God as the living God, as the Lord of hosts, as Jehovah, the God of his people, as the one who had delivered David in former times. David's view of the Lord is revealed to us in another passage that relates to this point in time in the book of the Psalms, in the Psalm numbered 9. In the 9th Psalm, it would appear that the words are set against the background of the battle of the Valley of Elah. The title to the psalm is this, to the chief musician upon Muth Laben, a psalm of David. There are all kinds of speculations about what that word should be in the Hebrew. But taking it as it is, and not what men think it might be or should be, taking it as it is, it literally means the death of the one who stood between. Now that final part there in the title of Psalm 9, the Laben part, that is very closely related to the word that is translated champion in 1 Samuel 17. Literally, when Goliath is described twice, two out of the three times in 1 Samuel 17 where the word English word champion appears, it is a word that literally means the man who stood between. In other words, he's the man who comes out into that space between the two armies, who dominates, who masters that space. And you have the idea of a man prominent coming out as a champion out into that space to defy the men on the other side. And this, it is believed, refers to the death of Goliath. It is a very interesting psalm because it does give to us a view of David's thoughts about the Lord on this particular occasion. Perhaps most striking is the words of the verse 4. Thou hast maintained my right and my cause. Thou sattest in the throne, judging right. David went to meet Goliath with his eye upon the God who sat on the throne. Thou sattest on the throne. Thou maintainest my cause. David knew there was a cause, the cause of God. He said, is there not a cause? Is there not a reason to stand and to fight? And he has his eye on the Lord, the one who maintains his own cause from his throne in glory. He's a man like so many others who had a view of God upon the throne and they feared not the face of men. Like Micaiah, when he stood before Ahab and the hundreds of the prophets of Baal, he said, I saw the Lord sitting upon the throne. And so he just rebukes the king to his face and tells him, God's going to cut you off. Why? Because he'd seen the God of heaven on the throne. Isaiah saw the throne of God, Isaiah 6. Daniel sees the throne of the Ancient of Days and the overthrow of the kingdom of darkness. John seeing the throne of God numerous times in the book of the Revelation. Ezekiel seeing the throne of God in the opening chapters of his book. These were men of great valor in the cause of God because they had seen the Lord seated upon his throne. David, in faith, saw God's throne and said, is there not a cause? Is there not a reason, therefore, for me to stand, for me to fight? But having seen God, he doesn't therefore have the same view of Goliath that the other men had. That is very interesting. He saw God first. And in the light of what he saw of God, he looked upon Goliath in very different terms to the other men all around him. Verse 26, who is this uncircumcised Philistine? All the others could see the size of the man, his armor. Saul could see he's a man of war from his youth. The men of Israel, when look at verse 24, when they saw the man, they fled from him and were sore afraid. His physical appearance was such that it terrified them. How does David see him? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine? Now the use of language there indicates that David saw him not from a natural perspective, but from a spiritual perspective. Circumcision was the mark of belonging to Israel. It was a spiritual mark. And David looked at Goliath, he didn't see his size. That wasn't the perspective that he had of this man. He saw him in spiritual terms. He's an ungodly rascal. That's all he is. Who is he? Who is he? He's just an unregenerate Philistine. And who's he to be feared? You see how his view of Goliath changes, verse 36. The same thing. This uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them. Verse 45. Thou comest to me with a sword and a spear and a shield. Oh, he saw them, but they didn't bother him. Because he saw them from a different perspective. He saw them from the perspective of a man who says, I know the Lord of hosts. And I'm coming in his name, with his authority, his strength, his presence, his power. And all the swords and shields and spears in the world don't make any difference. Whenever a man sees God, his faith then, seeing God, seeing the enemy in a different light, he doesn't hesitate to act. Even though at this time he's only poorly equipped for the battle. And probably physically weary. He's just come on a fairly lengthy journey from Bethlehem to the Valley of Elah. And if you just measure that in a straight line on a map, it's at least 30 miles through the most inhospitable terrain in Israel. He had made that journey. And now he's going to fight. He may well have been weary. He may well have been physically tired. He certainly didn't have the accoutrements of battle. He's just dressed as a shepherd. And wearing the attire of a shepherd, using the weaponry of a shepherd, he goes to fight with this giant. Why does he do that? Because he has seen God. He not only sees the giant in a different light, but he looks on himself in a different light. He doesn't see, well, you know, this is madness, this is foolishness. Going to fight with Goliath, I don't have what it takes. I don't have the weapons that are needed. I don't have the talents. I don't have what I need to engage in this. But he didn't see it that way because he saw God. And his faith argued and reasoned within him, if God is in this, then God can give me the power and the Lord can give me the strength and the weaponry that is needed and use what I have. He had only a sling and 5 stones, but God can use it to bring down the giant. We can take courage from this because you know God does use those things that are small and feeble and despised. Isn't that what Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 1? In those verses from verse 27, God hath chosen the foolish things, the weak things, the base things, the things which are despised. Why does he do that? That no flesh should glory in his presence. God always works to bring the glory to his own name. If David had gone out armed to the teeth against Goliath, there would have been any number of people to praise David. But David going out just as a shepherd boy, poorly equipped as far as military hardware was concerned, there is the recognition, you know, this is the hand of God. This is the Lord doing this. The glory comes to the Lord. Because faith will always act for the glory of God in such manners. David acted that all the earth might know that there is a God in Israel. That's why he did what he did. That's what motivated him. Not the pride and naughtiness of his own heart, but that the earth might know the God that I know. When we stand up for the cause of truth, that's what should motivate us. Not pride in any human cause. Not the love of argument and debate and strife. Not a desire to make ourselves obnoxious. But a desire to bring the glory to the Lord. Lord, I'm going to stand for you. That all the earth might know. There is a God in Israel. And acting in faith, he was victorious. This is the victory that overcometh the world. Even our faith. He did overcome. The giant fell. The giant was brought down by the most unlikely means. Now it undoubtedly was a personal victory, but it was much more than that. It was a victory for his brethren. He had come to seek their welfare. And what welfare is secured for them by the defeat of this giant? Oh, what benefits will be brought to the cause of God if you and I under God are able to stand and to take on the giants of sin and the giants of unbelief and error and heresy and false doctrine and every opponent and everything that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. If the Lord gives us the victory in that, it'll mean more than just personal benefit. It brought a benefit to his brethren. It brought a benefit to his father's house. Did the king not say, I'll make his father's house free men in the land? Liberty and freedom brought to the whole household. It brought victory to the whole cause of God. The men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines. Their courage was restored. They engage now in battle and the Philistines are overcome and put down for a time. Every child of God can take courage from this victory. These things are written for our learning. It indicates what God can do with those who trust him. You mightn't have the weaponry. You might arouse the anger of many around you. You might be scorned. Mocked, and the flesh might press you hard. But if you stand for God, you trust in the Lord, God will use you. God used David, just a shepherd boy, giving no appearance on the outside of really any great prospects of victory or of power, but God used him, and he overcame. And this is an encouragement to us. That even though weak, despised, maybe at times not seeming to do very much, at times living in obscurity, even as David did at this point, coming from the sheep pastures to the battlefield, but God can use you to accomplish great things, to win great battles. Oh, that the Lord would take us up and use us even until that day when the chief shepherd of our souls appears to conquer all his and our enemies in the day, the great day of the battle of God. And the Lord help us to stand for him for Jesus' sake. Let's bow in prayer. Our Father, we thank thee.